Good morning and welcome to the Sunday Brunch, your weekly espresso podcast of news and views from Ireland. I'm Richard Delavan. Is Ireland really like Iran? Is 1916 a sectarian celebration? And will we ever know what really happened the day Robert Houlihan died? On our virtual panel to discuss these and what else is making the red tops bleed, the broadsheets blame, and the blogosphere boil over are two of Ireland's best-known bloggers, Mick Fealty of Slugger O'Toole and Gavin Sheridan. Good morning, gents.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Mick, let's kick off with you. You mentioned this, that you wanted to talk about this speech by Mary McAleese. So just take us briefly through what that was.
Yeah, well, it was... an address to a seminar in Cork. Looking back at 1916, it's the 90th anniversary of 1916, and really kind of a revisiting of that denial that it was an expression of narrow nationalism, that it was, in the context of its time, there was no other way for two countries to settle their disputes except by on the field of battle. And contrasting that very deliberately, historically contrasting that now with a much more kind of rules-based engagement between countries. And indeed, I mean, she kind of borrows phrases from Yeats's Easter 1916, right, suggesting that everything has changed and changed utterly. You know, today it's probably inconceivable, you know, that you could find two countries less likely to go to war with each other than Britain and Ireland.
That's interesting. But she used some pretty powerful rhetoric to describe people who might suggest that the celebrations being planned for the 1916 Rising are going to reawaken a kind of ugly strain of nationalism. I mean, she says that people who accuse the Rising, well, this is from Mark Brennick's piece in the Irish Times yesterday, Mrs. McAleese said last night that the source of the accusations that the Rising was an exclusive and sectarian enterprise was probably the tendency for powerful and pitiless elites to dismiss with damning labels those who oppose them. I mean, that's pretty harsh on anybody who raises these kind of questions, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I agree with that. And although, really, it's hard to conceive that the President of the Republic could do anything other than kind of back or kind of underwrite the founding myth of the Republic. I mean, it certainly, if anything, it probably does paper over some kind of important cracks. Not least when it comes to you know, that sort of the ex-territorial nationals sort of north of the border. One of the things that kind of put me in mind was with the launch of Vincent Brown's Village magazine a few years ago. Mm. He kind of dug back through some of his notes, and he picked up on a quote of something Paisley told RTE's man in Belfast back in the early part of the Troubles. And apparently Paisley said, if the people in the south really want Protestants from the north to join them in a united Ireland, then they should scrap entirely the 1937 constitution and ensure the Roman Catholic hierarchy could no longer exercise an improper influence in politics. Now, that was 35 years ago, but it was precisely the way that northern Protestants, and you know, the most famous of northern Protestants was, you know, it's hard to see that as anything other than a reasonable criticism nowadays. And in many ways, you know, the Republic has moved so profoundly away from that the paradigm that gave birth to the 1916 Rising. I do think there's a certain kind of papering over the cracks. I think what she's at base trying to do is to see 1916 in its own discrete space, in its own sort of time, and try and revisit the aspirational rhetoric of the time rather than the sort of, you know, the kind of reality of what actually happened on the ground.
What do you make about that, Gavin? What do you make about this business about, you know, bringing back 1916 and you know, making a big to do of the centenary in 10 years' time? And I mean, how do you think this debate's going to unfold from, you know, from where you sit?
Well, to be honest, I'm quite confused by the whole thing because I really don't have any interest in the 1916 Rising. I mean, at the moment, I mean, I'm studying in UCC, and I didn't get to see Mary McAleese's speech, but I think bringing it back seems to be it's for political expediency on the part of Fianna Fáil, and Mary McAleese bringing it up now just seems it was appropriate for the 90th anniversary, but I don't know how the country will react in 10 years' time or what place the 1916 Rising will have in 10 years' time. It will be interesting to see how much Ireland has changed between now and then, and how Ireland will think of 1916. Because if the government is intent on bringing it back now, and bringing back an anniversary, how over the next 10 years will the Irish people's perception of the 1916 Rising change?
Okay. Just to move things on then, Gavin, so you were going to be looking at some of the things that piqued your interest in the blogosphere this week. What was something that grabbed you?
Something that grabbed me was the debate between Richard Waghorn and Fiona de Londres. They're having a debate about this report that came out, the Oireachtas Committee report on what's it called?
On the family and the constitution.
On the family and the constitution, yeah. And there's a very, very lengthy discussion between the two of them about
And Richard Waghorn being on Sicilian Notes and Fiona de Londres being on what's the name of her blog?
fdelondres.blogspot.com, I think it is.
Right.
And it's a very wide-ranging discussion between the two of them on everything to do with the report and on the philosophical and on the constitutional parts of in the overall thing of the report about mostly about homosexuality and its place in the Constitution.
So is it just handbags at dawn, or do they actually bring anything to the discussion that's substantive in terms of illuminating the different points of view and philosophy behind this? Because I think one of the things that, you know, any issue like this that comes up in the Irish media, in mainstream media, it seems like it's impossible to have a discussion about the basic philosophical points behind them because you wind up either being labeled a homophobe or racist or politically correct.
Well, Richard goes into a very, very long post about it, and he goes into the he goes in a lot of ways he goes into the philosophical aspect, while Fiona de Londres, obviously, who works in law, goes into the legal aspect and her opinions on the issue. But it is wide-ranging debate. There's a lot of comments, there's a lot of cross-linking, there's other debates on over on Wolfborn watching his blog, and a kind of a very wide-ranging debate, and it's great that there's so much space given to it. It's very interesting to read.
Yeah, what do you think about all of that, Mick? Is that something that got picked up on Slugger? The whole issue of the possible change in the Constitution, and obviously this is, if people aren't familiar with this has come up in the context of looking at possible changes about the definition of the family in the Irish Constitution, about to perhaps incorporate a broader definition that might include gay marriage, for example, or recognizing domestic partnership arrangements between heterosexual couples. But Mick, has this something that's come up on Slugger at all, or places that you've been looking at?
We haven't really picked up on the debate in the South. What we did do is to pick up on the first civil partnership ceremonies in the UK, which by happy accident was at Belfast City Hall, and we actually had a photographer down there to take
All
to take a
right.
few snaps of the happy couple. I mean, at the time, I did some kind of searching around to find out what the situation was in the Republic and where the debate was. It was fairly quiet at the time. I mean, the view that I picked up was that there actually might there is a major constitutional problem if you want to call it gay marriage. The way the UK has found its way around this is not to call it gay marriage, but to institute a legal ceremony whereby the property rights of both partners are guaranteed. I mean, currently, what happens is if you're unmarried or you know, unmarried heterosexual couples or homosexual couples can live together for 30, 35 years and have absolutely no rights as next of kin. Etc. So
Right.
the civil partnership ceremony is deliberately to try and close that gap. It doesn't require anything other than the signing of paper. There are no vows No, there are no legally enforceable vows spoken out loud, which there are in marriage. And the kind of pragmatic view that the UK legislature has taken is that that would that's not necessary in terms of what gay couples pragmatically need. So the idea that the Constitution of the Republic needs to be changed, I mean, my understanding is that it doesn't need to be changed if you go for civil partnership, but if you want to call it marriage, then it does.
Okay. And what do you? I mean, what do you make of the broader debate, Gavin? I mean, about this. I mean, like, there's been a lot of kind of coverage about this week. It's actually in today's papers. There's the magazine with the Tribune, my own stomping ground, Sunday Tribune, has their on their cover Anna Nolan on why she might one day kiss the bride, and talking and as a good, oh, what is it? Good three more pages actually by Tanya Sweeney on this. And there's been some. I think the Sunday Times had a column by Brenda Power on this as well, taking the Barney approach. I think taking Barney's definition of what a family is and suggest that maybe Barney ought to be a junior minister in this government. But we'll see if that happens. How do you make about how the debate's unfolding, Gavin?
Well, in my own personal opinion, I think that I can't see a problem for any change in the Constitution to kind of account for the change in society since 1937. I mean, I don't see any particular problem with it, and I don't really understand why things aren't being changed. And as for a definition of family, I mean, there was a very highly commented post on Sarah Carey's blog about this issue last week. It brought in a lot of debate and a lot of vitriol as well. But I think in general, I don't see a problem with changing the constitution. I mean, Ireland isn't the same country it was 60 years ago, and constitutions need to be changed in a lot of cases to keep up with changes in society, especially in Ireland in the last 15 years even. I mean,
do you think they will change?
I think with time things will change. I think give it another 10 or 15 years and more appetite for change. But as it stands now, it seems there's little appetite.
But you don't think we'll see a change then in the near future?
Maybe not in the near future, no.
It's interesting. I was looking at the Sunday Independent today, and this is something Eilish O'Hanlon has been tracking for the last couple of weeks. I mean, she pours hot water or cold water on people who want to change the Constitution, who say that it's perfectly possible to arrive at a kind of a reasonable situation without necessarily having to go into the Constitution. In fact, the Constitution is a sleeping dog that is best left asleep. Though this week, along with her article in the Sunday Independent, there's the result of one of their famous or notorious telephone polls that says 62% of the Irish population, according to the Sunday Independent, would support the idea of gay marriage. So I don't. There may not be great appetite for change, but I don't really see there's any great resistance to change either, which is a major turnaround from, say, 20 years ago, over the divorce referendum, when two-thirds of people voted against actually having divorce. So, I think, as far as Ireland's concerned, we're in a period of massive and rapid and quite profound change as far as these matters are concerned.
Yeah. Okay. Other things that kind of shook the world this week, obviously the election of Hamas in the Palestinian territories was interesting, and the Sunday Times, I thought, had an interesting lead story today. I don't know if you guys saw that, but the headline, Ireland as bad as Iran, says top Sharon man, suggesting that the senior advisor to the interim prime minister there, Ehud Olmert, saying that Israel is having to teach the same lessons to the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, as he has to teach to Bernie Ahern. And apparently this all came out of a response in the Jewish Telegraph, which is published out of Manchester, to this article that ran in the Dubliner magazine, which by Justin Keating, suggesting that I think, basically, if I recall correctly, this kind of slipped by me at the time, that Israel didn't have much of a right to exist. But I mean, what do you make of that contention? I mean, I was, you know, kind of surprised to see that headline, but I think, is it fair to say that that's going a bit over the top, Gavin? That Ireland is as bad as Iran?
Yeah, I think that's going just a bit over the top. I mean, to say we're as, I don't really support that view at all. I mean, I'm just reading here that Hamas is floating the idea of a Palestinian army, and you know, I think Ireland isn't any. I don't think it's. I think it has certain, obviously, as same as any European country, really has certain sympathies with the Palestinian cause more so maybe than the Israeli one, but I think, you know, there's no room to compare to Iran on any basis.
Yeah, I just find the whole thing mystifying, really, that how debate about these things unfolds over here. But but Mick, I mean, is this something that I mean, how does this come up on your radar screen? I mean, the way that this played out this week, you know, whether or not the EU is actually going to wind up even talking to Hamas, or if they are going to perhaps cut the aid. I think $7 billion have been sent by the EU since 1993 to the Palestinians. By some accounts, 90% of that went to Swiss bank accounts and mansions for Fatah leaders. But it's the way this seems to unfold over here is. It's just quite bizarre. I mean, do you think that we should be talking to Hamas?
I think but George Bush's remarks on it were very enlightening. I think when he was told about Hamas taking over, I mean, he was fairly unequivocal in saying, well, you know, that's the will of the people. Now, I mean, I think that's that kind of tells you something. You know, about how it's being read in the US, and I think the US accounts for something like $400 million. I'm not sure if that's an annual figure, but it's a figure I read this morning. You know, so Hamas has kind of got itself elected into power on the basis that the previous administration was widely seen as being corrupt and not delivering for its own people. It puts itself in a an interesting and complicated situation. You know, it now has major kind of stakeholders in its political enterprise, and I think it's going to have to find some way out if it's not to it's not to collapse.
Gavin.
I think it's hard to say, really. It seems that the conflict has kind of reached a crossroads in the sense that the Palestinians choosing to vote for Hamas in this way, and Hamas having now to choose which road to take, in a sense, I think it means that, you know, it's going to be an interesting few months anyway to see how things develop. And I think the Americans saying that they are cutting the $400 million of aid per year. I mean, I think the European Union should probably follow suit. I think I can't see any justification for giving such vast amounts of money to what is still a terrorist organization. I mean, you can say that the Palestinians voted for this party, but you can also say that there's no need for the US or the EU to fund this party. Just because the Palestinians voted for it doesn't mean we have to pay for it, especially if they're supporters of terrorism.
Well, but this is the question, isn't it? I mean, they dropped from their manifesto before this election their call for destruction of the State of Israel. And let me just say before I continue that for all our fans out there on Israel Pundit, I'm not endorsing Hamas, but let me just continue the discussion. They've dropped that from their manifesto. If anything, they seem to be the only political organization in the Palestinian territories that are providing things like healthcare and schools, whereas the Palestinian Authority seems not to have been particularly effective in doing that. So you just, I don't know, I think it's, I think that it seems pretty clear. And I was interesting before the polls were closed. There was actually an interview that got picked up by the BBC in translation with the leader of Hamas, suggesting that they already had been in talks with the EU. So I don't know. I think the EU is going to wind up having to deal with Hamas, and I don't know that the what'll be interesting to see is whether Mick, as you point out, that you know, George Bush says that this is the will of the Palestinian people, but you know, in the same breath says but we don't like what the that will has to say. I mean, aren't we in a transition period here that we're going to have to the EU is going to wind up having these talks, and the Americans and the Israelis are going to posture for a while, but secretly they'll have the talks. And, you know, I mean, PLO and Fatah were ostracized and no one would talk to them for 20, 30 years. And, you know, by the early 90s, they had to sit down. Don't you think the same thing was going to happen with Hamas?
I think that's likely. I also think, I mean, we do have to look at kind of some of the twin pressures that are on Hamas itself. It's not simply the pressure from the outside. You know, there's a certain amount of pressure on the inside. Now, it's not an area that I kind of read comprehensively on, and it's not something that I take a long term interest in. But it does seem to me, and this is always dodgy to kind of make comparisons here, but it does seem to me that there are some similarities with Northern Nationalists' choice to vote for Sinn Féin in large numbers. That didn't actually happen until the advent of the peace process, and the advantages that started to come to Sinn Féin electorally began to come in greater numbers once the Belfast Agreement was actually signed, and the intent to carry everything towards peace was intensified, and as has been argued by several commentators. You know, Northern Nationalists didn't vote for Sinn Féin to go back to war. They were sponsoring the move towards peace. Now, without knowing the Palestine-Israel situation as intimately as I do the Northern situation, it does seem to me that Hamas has won through on a twin mandate. One similarly to Sinn Féin in the North, they represent a strong kind of pro-Palestinian faction, for good or for ill. I mean, whatever the rest of us think about the actions of Hamas and suicide bombs and nightclubs and all the rest of it, within the Palestinian collective mind, that will be uppermost. But the other thing is, they're looking for to turn a new page. They're looking for good governance. They're looking for a party that will have to deliver on more than simply negotiations with Israel. You know, it'll have to tackle the law and order problem within Palestine, which Fatah has seemingly been unable to kind of turn on. And if they begin to kind of get some success in terms of turning around the domestic agenda, then some of the other things will naturally have to follow, and it'll require a certain kind of consistency across, a broad set of policy areas that Fatah just didn't seem to be able to deliver. So I mean, I wouldn't be too pessimistic. I think the short term, you can't really judge a chess match in the first two or three moves. I think you've got to see how things kind of pan out.
So what do you think about that, Gavin? Do you think? Sorry, go on.
No, I mean my view would be more optimistic than pessimistic.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that's a? I mean, other people made. I think Dermot Ahern made that parallel yesterday, or was asked about that parallel yesterday on the Week in Review on RT here, and I mean, there seem to be some pretty clear similarities between the path, before Hamas and the path that was taken by the IRA. I mean, do you think that's a bad analogy, Gavin, or what do you reckon about that?
I think traditionally I wouldn't have made an analogy between the situation in the North and the situation in the Middle East. I mean, I think that there's very, very big variances in the ideologies involved, because, I mean, seeking the destruction of Israel is not the very same as seeking the destruction of the United Kingdom. It's not, they don't interchange. But I think on this very specific issue, I think you can draw some comparisons between the kind of politicized mentioned the politicization of Hamas. I mean, Hamas, as I said earlier, I've kind of reached a crossroads where they have to decide, are we going to use, are we, I mean, I think they're going to get an appetite now for political power. And once they have that appetite, once they have this desire for political power, they might decide that, you know, the terrorist route isn't necessarily the best one. And they may say, look, we'll just go down the route of politics, and this is what might be the best way to get our aims.
Okay, so prediction: 3 years from now, will the Israelis be talking, sitting down with Hamas? First, you, Gavin, yes or no?
Yes.
Mick?
I go with Gavin.
Oh, there you heard it here first. There you go. Now, just to get to the other story that has been everywhere all week, has been the gut-wrenching case of Robert Houlihan and the sentencing of Wayne O'Donohue. And it is everywhere, I mean, today particularly. And every paper has a different take on this. I confess, I actually even bought News of the World, but not for that, because they had the Highlander CD, DVD with today's edition. But you know, Sunday World, Paul Williams, Robert the Truth about Gardaí are convinced Wayne did abuse schoolboy, whereas my paper, The Tribune, is you know, running a seems to be a bit confused about what its line is, taking a letter from O'Donohue's father that he wrote to Majella Houlihan, and there's actually reproduced copies of it, saying that he knows for a fact that nothing improper took place. And we should explain, of course, that what happened in that hearing was that Majella Houlihan, the victim's mother, read out an impact statement at the sentencing hearing, at which she raised certain questions about the investigation, and primarily about issues like the forensics examination discovered that there was semen on the hand of Robert Houlihan, and this has caused a lot of furore. Gavin, you're actually down close to where all this awful stuff happened. I mean, I don't want to press you on something if you don't want to talk about it, but I mean, what are we to make of all the ink that's been on this last couple of days?
Well, I think, I live, I don't know, 3 minutes from where it happened. So, I think these things have been going around Middleton for, you know, 6 months. I mean, this has been common knowledge of Middleton. Maybe it never got outside Middleton, but this information that came up, that Majella Houlihan brought up in her statement, was, you know, had been going around Middleton for quite a while, and I'd heard it all before, to be honest. I think in relation to what she said, I think really the victim impact statement wasn't designed for what she used it for. I don't think it was designed to make these kind of allegations. It's designed for other reasons. And I think she might have put the idea of a victim impact statement at risk by saying these things, because it amounts to allegations. It amounts to libelous allegations, I think. I think really, I mean, I think it's kind of, in a way, it's reprehensible that the victim impact statement was used in such a way. I think, and two of the papers today, they are the Sunday Independent and the Sunday Business Post, both kind of lead with stories that, according to forensic experts and forensic psychologists, in Mike Berry, professor of forensic psychology, is quoted in the Sunday Independent saying he doesn't think the crime was sexual. The evidence does not support the emotional outburst that Wayne O'Donohue is a paedophile. So I think, and the Sunday Business Post makes the same story on the front page. It says a leading U.S. forensic scientist has said the method used to examine the trace of semen in the killing of Robert Houlihan is unreliable and capable of producing spurious results. But I think in regard to the everything that happened, I mean, I think the solicitor involved, the solicitor on the Houlihan side, he made some really odd statements to the press. I mean, he was saying that the defense had an opportunity to defend Wayne O'Donohue during or after the victim impact statement, but that would have been an incorrect thing to do, and the defense would have been probably rightly pilloried for interrupting a victim impact statement or defending it during it. So I think really it comes down to what right does the victim impact statement have in terms of, yeah, can it be used in this way?
Well, I mean, but doesn't it, wasn't she raising, I mean, I don't know, I think that once they introduced victim impact statements I mean, it's inevitable that something like this is going to happen because you have very, you know, deeply upset and hurt, you know, families of victims given an opportunity. And in a case like, as you say yourself, everyone in Middleton knew about these questions. And I mean, the fact that it was such a shock for the rest of us to hear this, you know, outside of the local area or people who weren't, you know, journalists working on the case or Gardaí who had the information. I mean, wasn't it inevitable that that information was going to get out and that it would change the way everyone thought about the case? And in fact, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say here is that it wouldn't have been better if these questions had been adjudicated in the court. Like, for example, if the evidence had been brought up by the prosecution and the judge can then rule it was unsound or something like that. But rather than have a situation now where, you know, this information seems like this was some hidden secret and, you know, with some justification, the mother can claim that these things should have been adjudicated and weren't.
Well, I think what's happened is that the prosecution, the DPP, decided not to use this evidence because of its prejudicial nature, that this could, in the eyes of the jury, be prejudicial. And then there's been arguments on the jury are intelligent enough and smart enough to dismiss. Questions about what's going on. I think it's really, for me, it's the victim impact statement being used in this way. I mean, maybe it was inevitable that it would be used in this way, but I still think, was it right that it was used in this way?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I guess I actually, and you dropped out there for about 20 seconds. But I sorry. So, but I think the fact remains that, I mean, the thing is, we don't actually know why the DPP did or didn't do these things. We have anonymous sourcing. But, of course, as policy here, I mean, the DPP, again, who is spoken about as this person, in fact, there is a person who is the director of public prosecutions, a guy called James Hamilton. But the whole culture here is that we're not even allowed, it seems, to interrogate the reasoning. We know more about what, you know, Sam Alito thinks as a U.S. Supreme Court nominee than what James Hamilton thinks about, you know, in terms of how he or his office comes to the decisions that they made. So we don't know whether they decided it was prejudicial or not, do we?
Unfortunately not. And I think that's something to do with the culture of secrecy that abounds in the Irish state and it persists and with the increasing dumbing down of the Freedom of Information Act. And I think you have a point, but I think really, for me, I think there's using the facility of the court to make allegations that are still, there might be questions surrounding the case, but you're still making what I would consider libelous allegations because you're saying them without a recourse to defense for the person who's accused.
Well, if it was your child, I mean, you were then put in the situation where you believe that a miscarriage of justice has just taken place. That this guy is going to get away. I mean, this Wayne Dunne is going to be out of jail in 2.5 years. Magella Nohulhan knows this. She's given an opportunity. I mean, would anyone not have done what she did given the situation that she was in?
It's a very hard thing to call. It's a very hard thing to say what way anybody would go in such a situation. And to be honest, I have no idea what I would do in that situation. It's very hard to kind of sure. imagine the scenario you would be in. Yeah. But I think in general in Middleton, the feeling is, from what I can tell anyway, is that it's kind of one of neither supporting Wayne O'Donoghue or supporting Magella Hoolan. It's kind of a situation where nobody wants... It was said on the radio that when after the impact statement, the former mayor of Middleton was on the radio and he was saying that really there wasn't really any division in the town. It was really about trying to heal since the sentence and since the...
Right. Gavin, are you still there?
Yep.
Drop you there. Sorry. Mick, I mean, have you been following? I mean, you're at somewhat of a distance from all of this. I mean, have you been following this case this week?
Well, I mean, it's one of those cases that's hard not to follow. I mean, the kind of the event itself was fairly shocking. It does seem to me that there's been a lot of wild speculation around the case right from the very beginning. And at the very beginning, it was widely assumed, on very little evidence whatsoever, that there was in fact a paedophile connected with the case. Although it was widely assumed that this paedophile must have come from England rather than sort of anybody local. Now, I mean, this is very, very dangerous territory, it seems to me. There was recently, but a few years back, back in 2000, the case of Sarah Payne, who was abducted and killed in the south of England. And there ensued a massive and wildly hysterical campaign in which one woman was hounded out of her house in Portsmouth, and she was a paediatrician. And people had kind of clearly got the wrong end of the stick here. Mm. I think it's very, very difficult when it comes to children and vulnerability. I think the emphasis has to be on precision, and the emphasis has to be on investigating, all the available evidence. I think the outcome is. It serves nobody. I think it was the Sunday Tribune who said basically, it serves neither the victim, nor the person who's in the dock. That certain parts of the case may well have been sort of left out. And it is a deeply unsatisfactory situation to find ourselves in.
Yeah.
And people are open to kind of other speculation. It's not a good situation.
Yeah, I think that I think in Ireland on Sunday, just trying to find the piece. I think Mary Ellen Sinan, I think, makes the point that grief has no place in a court of law. But then, and I think this brings into question. I think this outcome brings into question the whole issue of victim impact statements about whether these, having these things at all is something that isn't necessarily serving the process. So just to end this item, and actually we come up on the end of our podcast, is do you think we will have victim impact statements in, say, 3-4 years, or do you think we'll have gotten rid of them, and do you think we should keep them? Gavin?
It's a hard one to call, really. I think victim impact statements do serve a purpose in a court.
Well, let's limit it to murder cases, because I know that there's a very good. I mean, the reason they were brought in initially was for sexual assault cases or very serious attacks assault. where the victim can speak for him or herself. So let's limit it to murder cases. Sorry, go ahead, Gavin.
I think perhaps maybe for cases in which the person involved is not directly implicated is probably a bad idea. So I think really, I think the current law should stand that it's legally obliged for sex cases and for assault cases, serious assault cases. But I think in regards to the other thing, I mean, it still remains the at the discretion of the judge. But I think perhaps even kind of more consideration by the judiciary about whether to give a victim impact statement in the future or not.
Right. Mick?
I'm not sure I got a view on it. I've not really come across it before. I mean, in the UK, it's only been piloted in the last couple of years in Scotland. I don't really have a kind of a clearly thought out view on the matter at all.
Fair enough. Okay. All right. Just last quickly, anything else that caught your attention this week, just to mention, Gavin?
Actually, today I came across a really good article in the Sunday Times with an interview between Jasper Gerrard and Boris Johnson. Very, very entertaining interview, as always. Anything to do with Boris Johnson is usually quite funny. He has a very good quote, if I'll just find it here. He says about editors, he says, he's written a new book about Rome. How did Rome manage to unify Europe when the European Union can't do it? And he says that the man organizing the mass carnage of the games in the Colosseum in Rome was called the editor. How little, he says, mutation there has been in the meaning.
Mick, anything else catch your attention this week?
Well, you know, Big Bird's on its way to Belfast to teach us all not to be sectarian. So I think the speculation is going to be, you know, about Bert and Ernie, which one's the prod and which one's the tig?
Well, we'll look forward to seeing that. And you can read more about that, I'm sure, on sluggerotool.com and some of the items Gavin mentioned, I'm sure, on Gavin's blog. But for me and for our panel, this is Richard Delavan saying have a good week.